Welcome, everyone, to our Fixed Income Focus, Navigating Markets and Opportunities with Lord Abbott episode. I'm thrilled to welcome Patrick Lang to the OPO podcast. To give the audience a brief background, Patrick is a regional manager of advisor services at Lord Abbott & Co., where he's been an invaluable partner to our team over the years. Patrick truly serves as the advisor to the advisor, connecting our team with extensive resources of Lord Abbott to help generate fresh ideas for our clients, whether it's through their market and investment insights, intellectual capital, or business building tools. Patrick and his team have been instrumental in helping us navigate today's evolving investment landscape. With 26 years and counting at Lord Abbott, Patrick has built a stellar career and reputation in the industry, and we're excited to have him here to share his insights with us here today. So Patrick, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, Happy New Year. Thank you very much for having me on the call. I was really looking forward to this.
Happy New Year. And what better way to kick it off than a discussion with Lord Abbott? Okay, everyone. So this afternoon, get ready, everyone, because we're really going to dive into the shifting winds of the fixed income markets as we journey deeper into 2025. Now, Patrick, if it's okay with you, let me set the stage with a little weather analogy. So imagine being from New York and New Jersey, and you're escaping to Florida in January, dreaming of sunshine and warm breezes, only to find a cold front moving through. Suddenly, the Floridians, including myself, are bundled up in our Patagonia sweaters, and even the palm trees look confused. And if you've been following any South Florida news, you've even heard of those dramatic but true stories of frozen iguanas tumbling out of the trees. But I digress. Iguanas aside, this is kind of what the fixed income markets feel like right now. And what I mean by that is that you're expecting calm and comfort, but you're getting unexpected turbulence instead. So let's jump right in. Patrick, what do you think the journey into 2025 has been so turbulent for fixed income? And can you highlight the major drivers influencing markets right now?
Absolutely. I think that is a terrific analogy. So last year, people's expectations heading into the year proved to be extremely different than what reality was. So you begin the year last year, and there was this sense that the Fed was going to cut rates and cut rates aggressively. And the market had priced in the beginning part of the year, seven, upwards of eight interest rate cuts. And then the market quickly realized that that was unlikely to occur. And the bond market corrected a little bit. And you sort of went back and forth with expectations that rates were going to go up and then rates were going to go down. And all year long, people's expectations were not met. And thus, there was a lot of volatility in the bond market. Now, not all bonds performed badly last year. So here's just sort of an indication of the bond market as a whole last year. And then that leads us into this year. So last year, high yield bonds did the best of traditional fixed income categories, doing about 8.7, which is 8.67 to be exact, percent. 30-year treasuries did the worst, again, of traditional fixed income categories, down 1.9. That's a pretty big difference between the best performing category and the worst performing category. The Barclays Ag, which is just sort of that, you know, quote unquote bonds market, a good representation of the bond market as a whole, was up 2.9. Right? So you had a fair amount of choppiness in the bond market last year, in large part because people's expectations in the beginning of the year were not met. We did not wind up getting the meaningful amount of interest rate reductions that people thought we were going to get. We did get some. We got it at the end of the year, that they lowered rates 50 basis points in September and another 25 in two meetings after that for a total of 100 basis points. But in the beginning of the year, the market was anticipating twice that, maybe a little more than twice that, right? So that did cause a lot of choppiness and uncertainty, and it's still causing volatility today. So here we are, new year, same problem. People are sort of trying to wrap their mind around the idea of inflation and interest rates, and that'll likely cause some choppiness in the market for the foreseeable future in the bond market, the next 6 to 12 months in our viewpoint. Doesn't mean there won't be opportunity. It doesn't mean that there won't be areas where you can make good money in fixed income, but there likely will be some choppiness for the foreseeable future.
Got it. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And thank you so much for that overview. Love what you're saying there, especially you hit the nail on the head with interest rates, right? It's definitely been a bumpy ride. Expect volatility. And in a way, 2025 feels like a day where you're expecting sunshine or those interest rate cuts, but you end up with gray skies and a brisk wind. However, I think that it's not such a total storm, but it's unpredictable enough that you want to keep a jacket, or in this case, a well-diversified portfolio handy, given how much you were just harping on which asset classes performed better than others. And really, speaking of jackets, let's talk about central banks. I can't help but think that they've been adjusting policy kind of like a thermostat in a home, turning the heat on and off, trying to get it just right. So, Patrick, what do you think interest rates have essentially impacted the markets to that degree? And what's Lord Abbott's outlook on rates as we move deeper into 2025?
Sure. So interest rates, of course, as you well know, you've done this a long time. Interest rates are a tricky business. It's hard to predict the future. It is, I would say, even harder to predict interest rates into the future. But there is a couple of good rules of thumb that might help simplify fixed income to a degree in people's minds. So I just tell people, if you think of the bond market and if you think of interest rates, the front end of the curve, so the 2-year and in maturities, that historically has been the bond market's opinion of the Fed. And it's the bond market's attempt to predict what the Fed is going to do and what the Fed is thinking. The 10-year treasury and out is the bond market's opinion of the economy. So when people say, well, what do you think rates are going to do? It's important to figure, well, which rate are you referring to? If you're saying short rates or longer rates, the 2-year and in or the 10-year and out. So let's start with the 10-year, because that's been the area that's been getting most people's attention the last couple of months.
And maybe you could also explain why we use that as a barometer too.
Yeah, sure. So the 10-year treasury is an important rate. So that is the one that I would say most people pay attention to. For instance, most mortgages, certainly not all mortgages, but a very large amount of the mortgages, most, I would say, are based off of the 10-year. So a lot of borrowing rates across our economy are based off of the 10-year. So as the 10-year goes, so does borrowing rates for consumers and corporations across the country and the globe, for that matter. So it's an incredibly important rate. And, you know, what I said earlier, so the rule of thumb about the 10-year is that it's the bond market's opinion of the economy. And there's an equation for that, right? In fixed income, everything is quantifiable. So the 10-year, what bonds people would tell you is the quote-unquote fair value for the 10-year is GDP plus inflation. So start there. The Wall Street consensus for this calendar year, and we can debate whether or not consensus proves to be correct or not correct, but let's just start with that indication. The consensus is for for GDP to be roughly 2%, and for inflation, as the Fed defines it, to be roughly 2.75. So if the 10-year is GDP plus inflation, 2% GDP, 2.75 inflation, that would be the quote-unquote fair value for the 10-year at around 4.75. As we're talking, it's just a little under 4.60, 4.58, I believe is the exact number as we're speaking. So that would imply the 10-year goes up a little bit from the current range. But the good news is that would also imply most of the interest rate movement we're going to see has already been felt. So most of that headwind of rising rates has likely already been priced into the market. So that's the good news, at least for that. The 2-year and in, that's the bond market's opinion of the Fed. And people like to predict, well, what's the Fed going to do? We would argue the Fed has two more interest rate reductions or two more interest rate cuts in store for us. They probably skip the next meeting in January. They likely skip the meeting after that. But we would believe that the Fed funds rate will be roughly 50 basis points lower than it is today by the summertime, right? And we would say that the Fed's going to cut rates for two reasons, in our viewpoint. The first reason is there is room to do so. So the Fed has stated this publicly in the past that they believe the neutral rate for Fed funds is a Fed funds rate that is about 50 basis points above inflation. So again, if the consensus number for inflation is 2.75, that would put Fed funds rate on a neutral stance around 3.25. We're currently at 4.25. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to lower rates 100 basis points from here. They might need to be restrictive. That's entirely possible to make sure inflation doesn't pick up too much. But they've got room to cut rates 50 basis points, still have Fed funds rate comfortably above inflation, still be modestly restrictive, and prevent, at least in their viewpoint, prevent inflation from picking up in any meaningful way. So we'd say that they're going to cut rates because they have room. But there's another reason, and we'll admit the Fed is not supposed to think this way. This is not their job per se. But it's kind of hard to ignore. Our country is massively in debt. I don't think that that is a secret to anybody.
No.
Most of our debt lives on the front end of the curve, right? And this has been every president for our entire lifetimes has essentially spent too much money. Right? It's not Republicans' fault. It's not Democrats' fault. It's everybody's fault. We're $36 trillion in debt as a nation. And most of that debt, 86%, matures over the next 3 years. The cost of that debt will increase significantly if the Fed doesn't cut rates. Right now, the cost of our debt, interest on our debt, is about $1.2 trillion. That's more than our defense budget as a nation. That number will increase meaningfully in the next 3 years if the Fed does not cut rates. It is in their best interest. It is in our country's best interest, if you will, for rates to be lower. It'll lower the cost of our borrowing. So we would say that it's in the government's best interest to lower rates. They have room to lower rates. They will lower rates at least modestly. Now, they can't wave a magic wand. They can't lower rates back to where they once were back in 21 when rates were at very close to all-time lows, because inflation is still a thing. But to the extent that they can lower rates, they'll likely lower rates in our viewpoint. Maybe not as much as we all hoped for originally, but still a little bit lower than they currently are. We would say short rates come down a little bit, maybe 50 basis points from here. The 10-year maybe goes up a little bit to something a little closer to 4.75 from about 4.60 or so, where we currently are. So modest movement in rates, a steepening yield curve, getting back to something that looks a little bit more normal.
Thank you. That's a really concise overview, Patrick. Really appreciate it. So essentially, just to sum that up, no immediate relief, but opportunities are forming as we adapt to this new normal. So with that in mind, let's talk about opportunities. And when you look across the fixed income universe, where do you see Lord Abbott talking more and more about relative value opportunities or potential mispricing? Are there any specific areas that come to mind that stand out right now?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. So here's a study done by one of our competitors, a very, very reputable, good firm on Wall Street, showed that if you went from 1976 to close of business in 2023, so not this past year, the year before, 98% of your total return in fixed income was coupon. In essence, coupon is your return with very little exception to that. There are exceptions, but they're rare. So I'd say coupon is the majority of your return. Why is that important? Think of municipal bonds. Municipal bonds across the curve from short to intermediate to long yields more today than they did a year ago today. Right? So yields are higher in munis across the board. If yield is the majority of your return over time, that would imply today is a much better entry point than it was at this point last year. Right? So we'd say munis, at least in terms of yields, look very attractive. I'll come back to that point in just a second and be a little bit more specific. But as you dig deeper on munis, we would argue that the fundamentals also look very good. So most municipalities in this country have a fiscal year that ends at the end of June. So we're about halfway through the fiscal year for a lot of municipalities. Most of them are running with a surplus at the moment, right? Most of them are pretty healthy. Most of them have very high rainy day funds, which is exactly what you think it is, money set aside for a rainy day. So they're in good position should a hiccup in the economy occur. And most of them are experiencing record high tax receipts, which is their version of earnings, if you will. Because the unemployment rate in our nation is so low and wages are up so much, tax receipts are actually quite high for most municipalities across the country. So I would say not only are yields much more attractive today than they were a year ago and 2 years ago and 3 years ago, but the fundamentals are also very strong. So I would say that municipal bonds on a tax equivalent basis, we like across the curve. I would say that that is an interesting opportunity in munis. On the taxable side, if we think intermediate rates go up maybe just modestly, but short rates go down modestly, that would imply a coupon plus return on the front end of the curve, where it might signify maybe more of just a coupon return in intermediate. So we would say that we still favor the front end of the curve. As you know, we've spoken about this for years. We prefer the front end of the curve now for several years. That is proven to be the right spot the last several years. We still think it's the right spot, but we're starting to like intermediate a lot more than we have in a while because, again, we don't think rates are going to move all that much in intermediate. So we still favor the front end of the curve on taxable. However, when you think about intermediate, we're not telling people to not own intermediate. There's an old saying in our business, and that is you invest on the probabilities, you diversify on the possibilities. Right? There is a while nobody happens to be calling for this. We're not calling for it either, by the way. But everyone assumes that the economy is going to grow this year. Everyone kind of assumes that we'll avoid recession, the economy will grow, albeit somewhat slowly. That's our base case. There is at least a chance that we are wrong. It wouldn't be the first time that the market as a whole was wrong. Consensus is wrong fairly often, actually. There's another old saying in our business is you never get hit by the bus that you see, right? What could go wrong? It's probably nothing that we're currently anticipating, right? It's likely going to be something that nobody saw coming, right? And if you think back to the 10-year, I said the 10-year, the quote-unquote fair value is GDP plus inflation. So if we head into a recession for a reason that maybe none of us anticipated, GDP, of course, would be negative, right? That's part of the definition of recession. So that means the 10-year could fall precipitously in that environment. You do need, if you're a diversifier, if you're going to diversify and asset allocate a client, you have to have that intermediate investment grade, in our opinion, because you need something that'll truly zig if the market zags, something that will actually offset the volatility on the downside, right? So while we might prefer the front end of the curve, and we would argue maybe the overweight should be on the front end of the curve, you should still absolutely have intermediate for that what if. Hey, if our base case is right and rates don't move a lot on intermediate, then you're going to get coupon returns. If our base case is wrong and there's a recession, then you're going to get a great return in intermediate, right? So we love munis. On taxable, we would favor the front end of the curve, but we would not ignore intermediate. There's certainly some opportunities there as well. That kind of makes sense?
It does. And just to summarize, it's about being selective, but identifying those warm patches amid the cool breeze. And really what you're saying here is this isn't a time to necessarily take on unnecessary risks, if you will, but it's really about finding that right balance. And I love how you were talking about being able to diversify, especially with the intermediate part of the curve.
Yeah, and Deborah, you've seen these types of charts before. I think this is an interesting quote for people to sort of wrap their mind around. It's like those quilts charts, which will take each year, they'll take the best performing asset class and stack rank them all the way down to the worst performing asset class.
Right.
They do it every year over a period of time. In the last 13 years, if you just did fixed income and you said, okay, just traditional fixed income categories, best to worst performing category each year for the last 13 years, the average difference between the best performing category and the worst performing category on an annual basis is a lot more than everybody thinks. You ask the typical person that question, what's the average difference between the best and worst performing fixed income category on an annual basis? You usually get somewhere between a 3 and 5% answer. The answer is actually 16. The actual 16% is the average difference.
Wow, that's staggering.
So we sort of tell people, like, think of that as the cost of getting it wrong. Now, if there was an anomaly in the bond market where there's a clear place where you want to back up the truck, so to speak, then yeah, take the chance. But in lieu of an anomaly in the bond market, and we don't see a lot of anomalies right now in the bond market, we think there's opportunity at the margins in a lot of different places, but there's no gigantic opportunity in any one spot. We'd say if there's, in lieu of an anomaly, don't take the risk. The cost of getting it wrong is too severe. Spread out your risk, diversify your risk in a lot of different areas. Pick up pennies in a lot of different areas rather than putting all your eggs in one basket.
Love it. Key principle of diversification right there. So let's actually keep moving on and let's talk about credit conditions, because these are some questions that I get a lot on client calls, and they're always a hot topic, especially in this environment. So how do you see credit quality evolving this year? And since we are talking about risk, are there any specific risks or, on the flip side, opportunities that investors should keep on their radar?
Yeah. So when you think of risk and credit risk and fixed income, high yield comes up a lot. That's sort of where you see the credit risk arise more often than not. Certainly not only there, but that's what people tend to think of when they think of credit risk. The historical average default rate of a high yield bond is 3.4%. Wall Street consensus for this year is about 2%. So a meaningfully lower default rate yet again, for a couple years in a row now, a meaningfully lower default rate than historically normal. So we would say that is an indication that corporate America is in fairly good shape. The balance sheets are in fairly good shape. And this is indicative of back in 21, at least in part indicative, I should say. It's not the only reason, but it's certainly a big reason. A lot of companies refinanced their debt back in 21 because rates were very near their all-time lows. And they locked in those lower rates for a long time. So even though rates have gone up and thus the borrowing costs have gone up, most companies have most of their debt in much lower cost. So it hasn't really impacted them yet. It might impact them out into the future, but it has not impacted them yet. So we would say at the moment, credit looks fairly healthy, that the cost of debt is not very high. The outlook for defaults are relatively low relative to historical norms. And thus, they look pretty good. A lot of people will say, yeah, but high yield spreads are really tight. So spreads, of course, being the yield on high yield relative to the yield on treasuries. You should get paid more for taking that incremental additional risk. And that spread, that difference in yield, is less than it's historically been. And that causes a lot of people some concern. But we would say that there's a reason that that spread is less than it's historically been. And that reason is companies are high yield index as a whole is higher quality than it had historically been. So you are, at least by credit quality standards, taking less credit risk than you've historically taken. And the index is a lot shorter than it's historically been. So because I'm taking less maturity risk, or i.e. interest rate risk, and less credit risk, spreads should be tighter. And we're not saying that high yield is a screaming buy per se, but we're not particularly afraid of it either. That we would say that credit this year to us looks fairly good. And if our base case is correct, so if our base case is short rates come down a little bit, we avoid a recession, that the economy continues to grow, and defaults are below historical average, they stay low like they have the last couple of years, then short high yield as an asset class, we would say looks pretty attractive, as does other areas in that credit world look fairly attractive, like private debt, we would argue looks fairly attractive. They tend to be much shorter in nature, 5 to 7 years, tend to pay a nice coupon. Again, if you avoid recession, short rates come down a little bit, that space should do very, very well. So we tend to be favorable on credit as a whole, especially on the front end of the curve.
Okay. So even as the air is getting chillier, there are some places where the sun is shining through. And at UBS, we would agree with you in the fact that the key is to stay vigilant and really focus on those areas that have strong underlying fundamentals, especially as they change over the years. So let's really turn our attention to the practical element of this discussion, and that's going to be with practical strategies. Patrick, what are Lord Abbett's favorite practical strategies or themes that you think investors should consider as they position portfolios for the remainder of 2025?
So the big part start with diversification, right? As we talked about earlier, cost of getting it wrong is severe. So diversification will be important. And what I also mentioned earlier from one of our competitors, a very reputable, terrific firm, did that study that talked about how 98% of your total return over time in fixed income is coupon. So we would say, you know, that coupon or quote unquote what bond people call that carry will be important this year. We think that you want to favor higher yielding instruments, an additional carry, if you will, that yield will be the majority of your return. So we do favor areas where you get a pickup in yield. So, you know, in lieu of treasuries, would say, hey, if you're going to be investment grade, maybe securitized credit looks really good. Whether that be CLOs or asset-backed securities or mortgage-backed securities, securitized credit is in many cases investment grade, but they come with a higher yield. And then we think that additional yield is going to give you additional total return over time. Private credit. Again, it's additional yield. That additional yield is going to give you a better total return over time, in our viewpoint. Favoring the front end of the curve, again, would say is going to benefit you because you likely have interest rates moving in your favor, giving you a bit of a tailwind. So it's a practical strategy, would say focus on additional yield or additional carry, securitized credit, private credit, high yield, focus on the front end of the curve. And munis, there we would say across the curve, we like. Assuming you're in the higher tax brackets, we do like that high, that the tax freeze across the curve from investment grade to below investment grade. Again, the fundamentals look good. The yields look good. Nobody likes paying taxes. I think that's probably a common theme among everybody. So we'd say munis, of course, we would argue look pretty good going forward. So we'd say that those would be, you know, munis across the curve at areas for additional yield, whether that's securitized credit, private credit, you know, short, high yield areas like that, we'd say are the practical areas in our viewpoint.
Perfect. That's wonderful. And I know, especially in a year as such, especially with the presidential inauguration yesterday, there's a lot on the table, right, that could happen, that might happen, or definitely has no chance of happening, right? And a big theme for us this year is talking about uncertainty. And I think that's something that you're very well versed in too, Patrick, is that despite a lot of uncertainty, you have to be able to formulate a fixed income strategy around it. And while markets definitely remain unpredictable, which of course can be unsettling or even rattle some investors, I know when speaking with my team each morning, really when we huddle in our team meetings, we talk about how the best advice that you can give clients is really to focus on what you can control, which first is always going to be your long-term strategy. Second, your risk tolerance. And third, your diversification. But uncertainty is always a part of investing, depending on how you view it. It could be positive or negative. But we believe that with the right approach, it can create opportunities rather than obstacles. And I'm curious to hear your take here, Patrick. What advice do you have for clients to navigate this uncertain environment?
Yeah, I think you touched on it there, where I think UBS does a very good job of helping people first understand what's their risk tolerance and what are their goals, right? So why are you buying fixed income to begin with? Now, in part, it is for income. There are certainly people that live off the income of fixed income. That is in part what they are for. But we would say in large part, they're really for diversification and helping control volatility in a client's portfolio. So we would say in our viewpoint, we've always sort of felt if you're going to take risk, take it in the equity market where you were, largely speaking, paid to take that risk. Fixed income is really much more to help control the volatility in a portfolio, diversify a portfolio, as well as income. So we would say, don't just focus on the income, although income is important. Understand what you're buying and why you're buying it. And we'd say you're buying fixed income, largely speaking, to diversify and lower the volatility of an overall portfolio. Even in a really bad year, like 2022 is one of the worst years on record for fixed income, and it was still down a lot less than the equity market was. It still helped control volatility. So diversification, control volatility, I think UBS does this as well as any firm on the street, helping clients understand what their goals are and their risk tolerance is and why fixed income is an important part of the portfolio to control that volatility for that risk tolerance. But I'd say like that would be, if I was going to say that, that'd be a big thing. I think you guys also do a really good job of helping people understand the fixed income for liquidity, longevity, and legacy. But this is also, it helps with those three L's. So we say we love fixed income in this environment. There's opportunities at the margins in a lot of different categories right now. They should be a part of everyone's portfolio.
Yeah, and I love that you just gave our three L's, our UBS Wealth Way, a quick plug there, because that's really the blueprint for financial success, right? It's about staying calm and staying committed to your plan despite uncertainty. And really to hit on those comments earlier, that I'm sure high yield is kind of all over the place in that chart. But here at UBS, we believe that discipline is your best friend in times of uncertainty. So as we start to wrap up here, Patrick, if you could leave our listeners with one last takeaway or aha moment, what would it be?
So I would say in terms of fixed income, the what I would tell people to focus on is the cost of getting it wrong in fixed income is severe. Unless there is an obvious opportunity in fixed income, you're not being paid enough to take the risk. Diversify your risk. Pick up pennies in a lot of different categories. Diversify your fixed income. Do not try to figure out which is going to be the best performing fixed income category. It is highly unlikely that you will get it right with any regularity. It is highly unlikely that you're going to get the direction of interest rates right with any irregularity. Diversify your risk in fixed income. understand it is there to help lower your volatility in your portfolio, not increase it. So we would say diversification in fixed income is key. Do not try to predict the future. Nobody is good at that game.
That's a wonderful perspective and is so overlooked at times too, right? I love how you just said diversify your risk. And I completely agree with you. You really have to be able to embrace the uncertainty and use it as a chance to position yourself for success. So, Patrick, thank you so much for joining me here today and sharing your insights. It's always fantastic to catch up with you and your team at Lord Abbott. And you guys have really been a tremendous wealth of knowledge to me over the years, which I'm incredibly thankful for. And I'd also like to thank our listeners for tuning in to the O'Leary Partners Observations podcast. And one last thing I'll say here is that whether you're currently braving the cold front in Florida or you're simply navigating the uncertainty of the fixed income markets, remember that preparation and perspective make all the difference. And keep in mind that if anything we said here resonates with you, our team at the UBS O'Leary Partners more than welcomes the opportunity to connect further, especially if you have questions about how your current fixed income portfolio is allocated, or you're just simply seeking a second opinion. But in the meantime, make sure you follow our page on Spotify and Apple Podcasts for more episodes, and I hope to catch you next time. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.